The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 174, an interactive musical play, The Defense of Cain, with Eugene Kovalenko, Birgitta Kovalenko, Natalie Palmer Shepherd, Dan Weatherspoon, John Allen Kovalenko, and Jim Wood.
This is session 174 of the 2005 Salt Lake City Sunstone Symposium, July 28th, The Defense of Cain. This is an interactive play in two acts. What you will experience is a radical idea. Suppose the biblical Cain was framed. The author asserts that the scriptural record is one-sided, that Cain has never had his day in court. This is that day. What are the implications of a possible ancient miscarriage of justice? How would that impact the LDS or Mormon Church and other religious institutions? And what can we do about it?
Please take a moment to read page one of your handout. Ladies and gentlemen, Old Father Adam, in many modern faces, has become master of an unstable world. Blind to his inner realities and preoccupied with his public image, he allows himself to be manipulated by ambitious wives. Claiming thus to be true and faithful, he piously rules in the name of God and law, oblivious of his part in the first great miscarriage of justice on record. So long as that injustice remains uncorrected, it repeats throughout the ages in infinite variations. Adam and the world he rules remain subject to sin, pain, and death. For millennia, Cain has roamed the earth as a vagabond, full of uncomprehending guilt and beset by misfortune. Surviving and evolving by the grace of God, he has finally learned his purpose and become strong enough to take his rightful place in the kingdom of God. Cain is now returning for justice at his father's table.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. And there's no sickness, no toil, no danger in that bright land to where I go. I'm going there to see my father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm just a-going over Jordan. I'm just a-going over home. I'm just a-going over Jordan. I'm just a-goin'
Well, well, this doesn't seem like the Cain of the ancient record. Is there something wrong here? Is this a case of mistaken identity? Or is there a mystery lurking that we would do well to understand? It seems we have new friends to help us in our task. One is Spim, an advocate for the defense and friend of the court. He is about to appeal Cain's case before Judge, who has a reputation for being tough, but fair and honest. We also have Prosecutor, who is feared and respected for knowing the scriptures and the common law. Let us now listen in to how the court is preparing for Cain's return.
May it please the court, I am representing Cain, our brother, who long ago was unjustly treated and cast out from his father's presence. It is our belief that this action was based on hearsay evidence. Therefore, this judgment will not withstand a rigorous review of the scriptural record.
Hold on there, sir, and back up a bit. By what authority do you presume to address this bench?
By special orders from the Cosmic Federation, Your Honor, because of certain judgment deadlines now facing your planet.
What, Your Honor? We won't recognize credentials like this.
We urgently request that you hear our appeal, Your Honor. There are incalculable consequences that will occur if this case is not heard at once. There is no time to lose. To reject our plea will waste precious time and force it to higher judicial levels.
Highly irregular. I wonder if you have been seeing too many science fiction movies. Explain yourself, sir, and do not presume to humor the court. What are these judgment deadlines?
Your Honor, it is my task to inform you that Earth is a carefully designed nuclear time bomb set to go off in the year 2012, or 500,000 Kolob revolutions for solar time zero.
What? Why, that's outrageous, Your Honor. Advocate, see here, this court will not be mocked or trifled with. Surely you can't be serious with such bizarre and hysterical claims.
Please control yourself, counsel, and kindly address this bench. Advocate, what you are saying is unsettling and frightening. Are you really serious?
Serious, yes, Your Honor, but it needn't be frightening. There is a cosmic plan for defusing the bomb, but it will be close timing.
I'm still deciding your credibility. Do continue explaining the Federation you speak of.
Gladly, Your Honor. Quite simply, our planet Earth is the Cosmic Federation's graduate school for planet managers. It was designed such that most of its inhabitants would not be aware of their greater purpose during most of their time here. This was for character testing purposes. Now it is time to awaken them.
I have never heard of such a thing.
The scriptural record speaks of this time and its attendant circumstances more than once, Your Honor.
Have you an example, counsel?
Certainly, Your Honor. At the time of his crucifixion and resurrection, Jesus appeared to many in this hemisphere and foretold of this present day.
And when that day shall come, it shall come to pass that kings shall shut their mouths. For that which had not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard they shall consider. For in that day, for my sake, shall the Father work a work which shall be a great and a marvelous work among them, and there shall be among them those who will not believe it, although a man shall declare it unto them.
Your Honor, that is not in the biblical record.
I refer you to the prophecies of Isaiah, Your Honor, the 11th, 29th, 52nd, and 54th chapters, and also the prophecies of Joel in the last part of the second chapter. Furthermore, the Apostle Paul refers to Isaiah's prophecies in his letter to the Romans, Romans 15, 21. There are many others.
I will take this under advisement, counsel. What did you mean by a plan for defusing the bomb?
The plan is this, Your Honor. Intergalactic volunteers, equipped with innate know-how, have been formed into diffusing task force teams and sent here to Earth on special assignments. Some are called Indigo Children.
Your Honor, this is getting more preposterous all the time.
This is well beyond my experience. What has this to do with appealing an ancient judgment?
If I may be allowed to establish my conceptual credentials, Your Honor, I will show how it has everything to do with the appeal. At this point, I am presenting concepts that I believe you will recognize, but which may lie below the threshold of your present consciousness. I ask only an open mind and a little precious time.
All right, counsel, you may proceed for now. However, be aware, we are without precedent at this point. I am allowing your sense of urgency to walk on unexplored ground.
Thank you, Your Honor. To continue with the plan for defusing the time bomb. For more than the past 25 years, task force team members have been and are continuing to be beamed undercover into selected Earth families to be trained and to adjust to Earth conditions. As individual team members mature and awaken to themselves and then to their new respective assignments, they move into new action relationships. Again, some of these newly awakening team members are called Indigo Children.
Your Honor, Indigo Children, this is getting preposterous, and none of that's on the record.
I am allowing unprecedented disclosure for the time being. Please continue, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Training becomes advanced as teams congeal into what might be called action crews. In such relationships, individuals learn efficient use of their respective talents and their metaphor dream internal guidance systems, at the same time that diffusing teams are learning to apply integrated dream team technology.
Back up a minute, counsel. What is all this technology? Without competition, how do teams or crews work together or get anything accomplished?
Interaction with other teams or crews may be direct or indirect. Awakening, training, and action assignments are all coordinated through the internal guidance system of each individual by the Federation's Central Administrative Intelligence.
Oh, Your Honor, have you ever heard so much mumbo-jumbo and mystical bozo-ness in your entire life? Why are we putting up with this?
I'm president of territory, yes, but hardly mumbo-jumbo. What is that Central Administrative Intelligence?
You might call it conscience, Your Honor. Conscience does not rely on the past or on tradition or on precedent. It is an inner state, an intuitive feeling that surfaces in response to outer events or conditions. It is a personal, subjective matter and something we might call private revelation. Our sensitivity to its promptings determines the quality of our action decisions. That is why teams and crews are always more than one individual. Overlapping subjectivities need objective checks and balances.
Your Honor, we do not need lectures on conscience and morality. Everybody knows what conscience is.
Advocate, please bring your remarks to a close.
Yes, Your Honor. The final objective of diffusing team training is for teams and crews to be able to respond to each other in practical exercise decisively and effectively in present time, with clear thinking and full emotional expression. Each crisis or problem is resolved as completely as possible in a given time frame, and results are measured in terms of satisfaction and harmony among all parties involved.
This all sounds fascinating. Why haven't I heard of such a thing before?
There was no need for you to know before now, Your Honor. Now is the time for you and the court in general to be tested.
See here, do not forget where you are, sir.
Confine your remarks to the bench, Mr. Prosecutor. However, Advocate, I must also say that you are approaching a contempt pursuit.
I do not mean to be impertinent, Your Honor, only clear and efficient. My intent is goodwill and service for the common good. My colleagues and I believe that you yourself are a member of a diffusing team in the very process of this court procedure. It is now time for you to awaken to who you really are. It is time to explore and test old, rigid, brittle attitudes.
Counsel, this is a hearing to test the merits for an appeal for your client and not a personal challenge to me. I warn you again that you are crowding your purpose.
My purpose is twofold, Your Honor. Your own judicial attitudes, as well as that of this court, are one consequence of the ancient judgment that we are appealing. I'm risking your understanding.
Your Honor, defense is attempting to undermine the very authority of this court and mislead us with personal challenges. He has far overstepped the bounds of judicial procedure.
Your point is well taken, counsel. Even so, we are nevertheless making an unprecedented excursion into new territory. Advocate, I am risking this court's patience in considering that your challenge is one of attitude rather than authority. I hope you are not taking us over thin ice.
We are on solid ground, Your Honor, and thank you for understanding. Yes, we are challenging attitudes, not authority. You who have dreams, if you act, they will come true. To turn your dreams to a fact, it's up to you. If you have the soul and the spirit, never fear it, you'll see it through. Hearts can inspire other hearts with their fire, for the strong obey when a strong man shows them the way. Give me some men who are stout-hearted men, who will fight for the right they adore. Start me with 10 who are stout-hearted men, and I'll soon give you 10,000 more.
Oh. Enough, counsel. I will allow the challenge you propose. This court will hear your appeal. Where is your client?
Thank you, Your Honor. Our brother Cain is on his way at this very moment. We have been sent here to prepare the way before him. May we proceed with the preliminary argument?
You may.
May it please the court, I propose re-examining the biblical account as it concerns itself with our brother Cain. There were no real witnesses to his alleged crime. All the evidence ever presented at any time in the official record has been hearsay.
Objection, Your Honor! This is blatantly untrue. Mother Earth herself, God himself, they were present.
Kindly allow defense to state its case before you begin your objections, Mr. Prosecutor. Defense may continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Like Jesus, our brother was betrayed. And like Judas, he was set up.
And who set Judas up?
I warn you, counsel, allow defense to present his case first before challenging it. Again, defense may continue.
Thank you. Unlike Jesus, however, Cain did not comprehend what was happening to him. Who specifically was his accuser? Who specifically came to his defense? Moreover, why has this matter gone unchallenged for so long?
This is all ancient history, Your Honor. The subject of innumerable studies. It's all very tiring. These allegations seem quite ridiculous, speculative, and useless.
Your Honor, this case calls for a re-examination of old rigid attitudes. Modern Father Adam will eventually be able to return to the primeval garden only when he restores his son's inheritance as a final offering to the Lord in righteousness. Holy fire will then grace Cain's offerings when his accuser identifies himself and kneels in obedience at the altar.
Counsel, these are astonishing assertions. Surely you will be able to support what you are claiming.
Yes, Your Honor. The initial setup began when Father Adam refused Cain's sacrificial offering.
Objection, Your Honor. The counsel is willfully misleading and misrepresenting the scripture. It was the Lord who refused Cain's sacrifice.
The record is not clear here. Adam and Eve were cast out from the garden for transgression. That is, for willfully disobeying a commandment of the Lord, and thus cut off from the Lord's direct personal presence. In this new isolated condition, Adam found himself alone as the first patriarch of his family, and took for himself the place of the Lord in their lives. That what was initially a divinely appointed position of stewardship now threatened to become a despotic usurpation of authority. What was once motivated by love eventually became motivation by intimidation. The change was gradual and subtle. Cain was brought up under patriarchal order, quite oblivious to these subtle changes in motivation. Adam was all the authority Cain ever knew. Thus, whether in love or in hate, to Cain, Adam was God.
Objection, Your Honor! I mean no disrespect, but I can no longer be silent. That's the most outrageous assertion I have ever heard.
Counsel will refrain from further outbursts. This court is well aware that the defense is shining radically new light onto an old, dark subject. You will have ample opportunity to present counterargument and cross-examine all witnesses. Do not interrupt again or you will be properly censored. Continue with your argument, Advocate.
Thank you, Your Honor. In refusing Cain's sacrifice, Adam felt a degree of power that he had not felt before his expulsion from the garden. He was able to manipulate his unsuspecting son by his patriarchal authority. It was, to be sure, a heady place, and we will see how it builds into a major injustice. This injustice gradually evolved as the consequence of an unchallenged and subtle shift from an initially caring paternal attitude. Here is my main point, Your Honor. Cain could not comprehend the rejection. He felt something was not right, but could not verbalize what it was. The record says,
Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell.
Adam then says to Cain,
Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted?
That is step one. It is a conditional acceptance based on parental standards and perfectly in order. However, here is step two, the critical point, which is not in order. Adam goes on to say,
And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door.
Here is the subtle threat that has tormented mankind for millennia, full of implied guilt. Adam had bought Satan's lie, and now, through a subtle shift in attitude, he now passes that attitude on to his son. It wasn't enough to say, Son, that wasn't good enough. Do it over. Instead, Adam had to add a threat. If you don't do well enough, you are guilty.
Do you dare to trifle with the sacred word of God, counsel?
I ask for open-mindedness, Your Honor. The scriptural record is indeed a sacred and honored account, the most precious document in our land. But it is the symbol for truth and functions as a foundation stone in a building of our republic and in our way of life. This I have assumed. However, to make more of it than it is to make it into an idol.
An idol? This is becoming insufferable, Your Honor. Advocate is challenging the very base upon which we stand. Censure me if you must, ma'am, but this is tantamount to blasphemy.
Your Honor, I'm finished with my initial remarks and would welcome prosecutor's rebuttal.
Then please address counsel's objectives.
Gladly, Your Honor. To see the base structure in a truer perspective is to know its real strength. Let us not confuse a foundation stone with the cornerstone itself. The sacred record was written by mortal and fallible men as they personally experienced God and the powers of heaven. Their inspired writings are nevertheless limited by their own perspectives, experience, and comprehension.
Objection, Your Honor! How long must the court endure such outrage?
I find no disrespect in Advocate's argument. Kindly proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Allow me to ask counsel a question in the area where he is well-recognized authority.
Ask your question.
Who wrote the biblical record called Genesis that we are now examining, and under what conditions?
Counsel, can you answer?
Of course. It was Moses in his official position as prophet of Israel.
Yes. And when was it written? During Cain's time or later?
Of course it was later.
Yes. Many generations later. Moses was, in fact, centuries removed from the actual event and wrote his account from legends handed down from father to son or from prophet to prophet. It was an intricate historical process. Nevertheless, allow me to return to my main point.
Your point is well made, counsel. Proceed.
So, it wasn't enough to give clear fatherly guidelines to Cain regarding his unacceptable sacrifice. Adam went beyond that and gave Cain the thought, learned from Satan, that he had somehow sinned for not doing well enough, a debilitating conflict. Cain was unable to verbalize his feelings or stand up to his father. Instead, said the record,
Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him.
You see from that, Your Honor, They were talking. There was no call for a vicious act.
Again, Your Honor, who is writing this record? Who actually saw the event? How do we know it was not an accident or self-defense? Cain was a farmer and unacquainted with combat. Abel, on the other hand, was a hunter and a shepherd. He was well acquainted with killing, both to protect his flocks and in preparing sacrifice. How do we know their conversations did not begin in a struggle to communicate brother to brother and then backfire from frustration, misunderstanding, or even freak accident? From the lack of evidence actually available, we can imagine an infinite variety of alternative explanations to account for it.
Your Honor, how can counsel presume so much with the sacred record? Cain confessed. He confessed his crime.
No, Your Honor. He never confessed. He expressed confusion, bewilderment, and guilt. Not guilt for a crime, but from rejection. We have seen that Cain could not speak up for himself or in the face of his father's disapproval, nor could he differentiate Satan's lie. Moreover, we have also seen how Adam was capable of sloughing off his own responsibility upon Eve in the garden after the first forbidden act, and also by intimidating Cain by an unacceptable sacrifice. So far as I'm aware, Adam, whether ancient or modern, has never taken responsibility for his own capacity to err. He has yet to confess or repent for any wrongdoing. That is an attitude that continues to generate resentment, hostility, and injustice in all his descendants. It is an attitude originally learned from Satan.
You are being very hard on Father Adam.
Yes. However, my real intent is to bring light to a fundamental attitude and show how it can affect all subsequent actions. I believe that this can be done by calling Adam and the record into account and into harmony with the everlasting covenant of God's grace. Otherwise, Adam and his world remain locked in time and unclaimed by Christ's ultimate sacrifice for all humankind. The crucifixion satisfied the demands of an impossible law, and the resurrection conquered the threat that originally defeated Cain.
What is past, Your Honor. We're in the present now.
We can speak of time as if it existed, not in terms of clocks or the rotation of our planet, but in terms of experience, a sequence of events or circumstances. The past affects the present and the future in such terms. That is the point of my defense. To effect a readjustment of ancient but fundamental attitudes in new light. Consider another of Adam's descendants and his responses to the Lord. I am speaking now of Jacob, son of Isaac, grandson of Abraham. Cain was no yes man, neither was Jacob. However, Cain was also no warrior. Jacob was. Cain lost the battle with his accuser in believing a lie. Jacob won his battle at Penuel, the place where he wrestled an angel. Cain felt fear and fled. Jacob felt fear, but held on to fight for a blessing.
Why is this relevant, Counselor?
To show the character of God in the face of individual initiative and determination, Your Honor. At Penuel, the angel blessed Jacob with a new name, Israel, which means he who strives and rules with El, or God. Jacob then acknowledged that it was God and not his own strength that had spared him.
And why is this relevant?
It is relevant to identify Cain with a new attitude, Your Honor, one that God has used as an example throughout history and the sacred record. Justice calls modern Adam into the ranks of Israel. He has learned and grown in his wanderings over the millennia, and the Prince of Peace has taken away his guilt. Now he is returning for an accounting at his father's table. He has a new attitude, a new understanding, and a new strength.
Counsel, this is a challenge that our audience must consider. This court will recess for a few minutes so that the respondents can take their place at the round table.
Well, again, Quite a different picture from what we're used to thinking about Cain, isn't it? Let all those who have evidence, assertions, objections, or further light and knowledge take their rightful place at the great human family roundtable. Please take a moment to read the second side of the instructions.
Okay, I'm going to read the instructions for audience for Act 2 just so that it's on the tape. This is an interactive dialogue with the audience. Suggestions for additional Act 2 characters are Adam, Eve, Lucifer, Jacob, and other ancient and modern figures moderated by Spim. The four horsemen of the apocalypse, famine, death, pestilence, and war, are also present. Cain, invisibly, enters as the black prince on the white horse of peace and safety. Note, there are as many different Act 2 performances as there are performances. Each is a unique event with a unique audience. In past performances, the imagined voices of Father, Adam, Mother, Eve, Abel, Seth, Moroni, Nephi, Lehi, Moses, etc., even Jesus, have spoken. This is the heart and soul and purpose of the play.
So those of you who, in your experience of this first act, have had characters or figures or impressions come into your mind or your heart, you're invited to bring those characters and speak through them in the second act. That is what we will now do in this part of the play.
You'll speak into that microphone there.
The standing microphone.
Well, I am Adam, and I'm here to, after this presentation, I have decided I need to reconsider my relationship to my son Cain. Being that I want to become as great a God as possible, I must be open to new experience and new opportunities to reintegrate those who may be lost.
Adam, I don't think you need to be nearly quite that quick to reconcile and to believe the ruminations of this strange fellow who claims to represent your son. For instance, in his presentation, he claimed that it was you who played the card of if you doest well, thou shalt not be blessed, and if not, you should be blamed. When in fact the scriptural record says, and the Lord said unto Cain, why aren't thou wroth? Why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou be accepted. Spim, our advocate here, claims that it was you.
I'm saying...
One moment, counsel. Would you like to respond, sir?
Do you remember saying that?
Gee, I'm a little confused right now.
Okay.
I'm suggesting that the record that we have here that claims the Lord has spoken is ambivalent. That is, we have Moses writing centuries later, and that's his presumption. I'm challenging that presumption.
Without scripture to guide us, what are we going to do? We're just going to toss anything up in the air and that's going to be the basis for our morality? This has served well. We have a society of healthy, happy people. All is well. I have never been able to understand, with all your cosmic indigo children stuff going on here, what on earth you're getting to. What's wrong with the world?
Calm down, Mr. Prosecutor. Yes, madam.
Mother Eve here.
Mother Eve.
I'm tired of all this fighting. It breaks my heart to see my children hurt each other, kill each other, wrangle like this. We are here on this earth to have joy, to glory in our intelligence. And what are we doing? We're killing each other, we're fighting, and we can't get past it. I am sick of it, and if you don't stop this, I'm going to disappear and you're not going to hear another word from me.
But what role does the biblical record, Mother Eve?
The biblical record stands. We shall love one another. We came here to fulfill the joy of our creation. Let us get back on track. The biblical record is construed by mistranslations and forgetful men and angry people.
But why favor that part of the Bible versus the parts that we've really been wrestling with today?
The parts that we should really remember, and we can get rid of all the rest as far as a mother is concerned, is love one another. And if you think that cannot replace all of this miscommunication that's been going on forever, you're wrong. We have to drop it and get back to love. And that is a mother's word, scriptural or not.
Thank you, madam.
I'd like to respond to the earlier question of the prosecutor here. As Adam, I agree with the quote from the Lord, but I have such close communication with the Lord that it's that we're sort of one and the same, so I'm not sure that's a good objection. The other thing, too, is that I think we all need to reconsider our acts, and I think this challenge is a very good one. But again, I would like to hear what the judge says in the final analysis here before we make any final decisions.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm Seth. And Father, I have never told you this. And it's typical for both father and mother to be expressing love. And Cain had a secret, and he told me about it. In the mountains to the south, there was a cave, and he used to go there often, usually at night. And I tried to find out, you know, what's... He just said he was meeting someone, and one time he came back just exultant. I said, "What's? You seem happy. You seem pleased. What's going on? And he said, "I have a plan." He said, "I've learned the great secret." And he used a word I'd never heard before, Mahan. I didn't know at the time what that meant. But it was a great secret. So he told me never to tell you. Even though he didn't really tell me until a few days later, I found out. I found the body. He didn't say anything about the body. I saw the blood on the ground. It's my older brother's. And it's so typical. It's so typical to blame father. Cain always blamed father. Cain never took responsibility for his actions. Cain always had some excuse or someone to point to. But not this time. You're not going to get him out of this. The blood was on. And you can't tell me that it was an accident. You can't tell me that the person who tills the ground doesn't have sharp tools. You can cast doubt. I was there, and you'll never convince me.
So as Mother Eve, I want to say one more thing, and that is, my heart broke when my son Cain could do such a thing. I loved him. I loved him just as much as I loved Adam. And now Christ died as a sacrifice for all our sins. And I am so grateful because Cain is redeemed.
Cain is redeemed. I mean, he sinned against the light. He is a son of perdition, if there is ever a son of perdition. How can you claim that?
I'm a member of the jury only in this great round table, but I want to ask counsel for the defense, why cannot we listen to Cain himself? Why is he not here? Could he be put on the stand?
I have no objection to Cain speaking for himself.
Counsel for the defense.
Is there no Cain here? I'm going to try to do something here. Cain was once on an altar being prepared for something he didn't understand. He was naked. He was being prepared by men in robes, patriarchal folk. He was like a lamb. But he had a blemish. Something was wrong with him. He didn't understand what it was.
He was marked, of course, for his sin by the Lord.
And so, the Cain I know never killed nobody. He didn't understand what was going on. And when that patriarch, who was the head of it, looked at him and said, "Out!" He was unacceptable. He was frightened. And he began running and left the scene. He couldn't defend himself.
Because
he
was
guilty.
He
had to defend. He heard angry voices, though, behind him. "I'll kill him, I'll kill him."
Eye for an eye. I mean, at that time, that would have been proper.
And then another voice said, "No, no one in this church ever better be found killing one of these."
Thank you. Do we have any other comments?
I'm a biblical scriptorian.
I recognize you, sir.
And scholar from the 20th century, or the 21st century. And the proceedings of this court illustrates very well what happens when the stories of our religion are used indeed in a way to be divisive rather than to unify. And we see right now the whole family of men being torn apart.
But Jesus instead himself, I have come to reveal who are the sheep and who are the goats.
Prosecutor, would you allow him to speak? Thank you.
When we use holy words for the purpose of making accusations against one another that can never be verified, four or 5,000 years have passed since the events that we're talking about, and now this court would indeed further drive wedges between the members of the human family. And some would even justify it as part of the final cleansing that has to come upon the earth. I say that the proceedings of this whole court should be viewed in a totally different light. That is, we should look at the scriptures that God has given us as teachers to us, and not as legal documents by which we will prosecute one another.
Thank you, sir. Do we have any other comments?
I rest my case, Your Honor.
I'm still having difficulty, counsel, with your position here. It still strikes me as insane to all of a sudden start announcing visitors and cosmic federations and Earth as planetary training grounds for future managers. Would you please give me a little bit more than that to go on here? I'd like to understand exactly, again, the curse and the time bomb that's about to explode if we don't get there. I just haven't quite been able to get through that.
I think if anybody were to look objectively at what is happening among nations in our present day, it's not hard to see that we have been on a nuclear abyss for some many years. In point of fact, the last stages of the nuclear trigger have come within seconds of being pushed by this country at least three times before 1974. The most notorious of those times is the Cuban Missile Crisis. We know about that one. There are others. That and those I know from personal experience with those who were there. The fact that we haven't done it, the fact that the bomb hasn't gone off by now, is a miracle all by itself.
And all this came because Father Adam started feeling his oats and said this, "If thou doest not well, you're under condemnation," to his son. That's the reason for this.
It goes right back to that initial attitude that has grown like a cancer.
I don't know. Any of you raise teenagers? How do you control them without an iron hand? How do you control them sometimes without, if thou doesn't do this, you're in trouble? I just don't quite understand how we're going to get past that when we have to raise them as children before they even become these cosmic conscience indigo children types that you're talking about. How do I get through that part as a parent with my child?
As a member of the jury, I find that a very weak position. We never tell each other, we never tell our children that they're cursed.
So they do something that you don't like that is obviously bad for them. Cursing may be a bit of a strong thing, but what about punishment? And what about the threat of next time you're going to get it? It seems like counsel wants to take that away from parental controls and ways.
Jane got it. It's done. I agree with Mother Eve. I'm coming to, Your Honor, I'm coming to a conclusion in this case myself.
Do we have any other comments?
Speaking as a young person of the 21st century, and in response to your question about this mystical mumbo jumbo, there are others on this planet that have been in communication with the spiritual world in perhaps different paradigms than the traditional Judeo-Christian church, and it is commonly recognized among indigenous cultures and other forms of spirituality around the world that we are at a point of spiritual consciousness and paradigm shift. And as verified by the LDS Church's comments about the present generation being a chosen one, and considering that these are commonly recognized as the last days, it seems fitting that new information and revelation and light would emerge to assist the human family with this shift.
Well, if it's been the last days ever since a century after Christ, how is it that it has any meaning whatsoever? Generation after generation have been called.
What about the signs in the scriptures that have begun to be fulfilled in the last couple of hundred years?
What about all the ones that haven't? You know, picking and choosing from the signs and things. I agree that the scriptures have begun to be fulfilled, but certainly it's God's plan that we do that the world does end in fire. The book of Revelation is clear that there's Gog and Magog, and there's the separation of sheep and goats. Well, and how is it that you're going to stand here and say
that? Let it all go to hell, then. Yeah, let's give up.
Well, I'm not saying that.
Okay, objection. I'm objecting.
All I know is you're revealing yourself. It seems like the purpose is to reveal yourself. And that it seems to be, to me, fine with what God has intended.
I'm Adam again. I'm coming back as more thinking is going on here. I think the prosecutor has a good point about some aspects here. If Cain is to be given a second chance, I think it needs to be clarified, and the court can only determine this, what in fact did he do and what he did, and if he did something very serious, such as the killing is noted, then there needs to be some form of repentance and change. In other words, the laws, as I understand it, cannot be just. There has to be some way of mediating all of this.
Well, the concern I have, I can be a judge or I can just be an observer, but the concern I have as we listen to these proceedings is, if a person sheds innocent blood, we have a witness that says he actually saw the body, saw the blood laying there, and we have an alleged perpetrator who ran from the scene of the crime. My question would be to all of you, if in fact there was one semblance, one inkling of innocence in what occurred, why would you run? Why would you run? Why would you not stand, face your accusers, and explain? Why would you run?
We all have different gifts. Some people have the gift of courage more than others. Some people are bigger than others. We're all different.
That's true.
Mother Eve again here. I watched as these boys were growing up, and I saw some favoritism. I saw some mounting jealousies. I realized that Cain probably lost it, and then he realized what had happened. He was so frightened. He had really done what he did not want to do. I know his heart as his mother. If we could each look into our own hearts to find love, to find forgiveness, that is the only way we're going to shift this paradigm. As long as we're calling for justice, as long as we're calling for even Stephen, as long as we're looking to punish, we're not going to make it.
But how do we survive without something
the only
like
way,
justice to honor?
As far as I know, the only way we can do this is in each of our own hearts. We cannot go around expecting it from others. We have to look only in our own heart. And when you can have in your heart a relationship with your older brother, Jesus Christ, you can talk to him about it in your own heart. See what Christ says to you about this issue, and let me know.
Your Honor, I would like to tell the court the defense objectives for this trial, for the record.
Okay.
The defense would like Cain pardoned and to be able to claim his inheritance. The defense would like Adam to take responsibility for his own judgments and capacity to err and to misjudge. The defense acknowledges Christ and his promise to assume all debts and sentences, freeing all confessing prisoners. The defense would see that Satan be silenced and that the enmity that he has brought into the world be removed.
Do you have any comments to that, prosecutor?
I'm just wary. I'll think about these things.
Does anyone else have any comments to what the defense would like to have happen?
As a member of the jury, I've been thinking about this too, and it seems to me that that Cain has suffered an awful long time. As whether it's legitimate or not, I think you could say that 5,000 years is a long time to have to suffer with having all of mankind see him as an evil, murderous man. There was been no murders before he came. He didn't know what it meant to die. He didn't realize what he was doing at that time until it was too late. And there's opposition in all things. We know that. That's part of why we're here. And I think we need to learn how to not cast the first stone, to learn how to forgive. That's what Christ taught us. He taught us not an eye for an eye. And I think it's time that we start to learn this lesson. And I think that we all are born as children of God. We all have the goodness in us. How can we always hold everybody down? Yes, we take a chance of not controlling our teenagers, but they have a free agency. They need to be free. We can't hold them down. The more we hold them down, the more they're going to rebel. We have to learn to trust and take the consequences of that.
Along those lines, I agree with you, and I thank you for that, member of the jury. We need to remember exactly, just to reiterate a little bit of what you said, that one of his things is that Christ assumes all debts and sentences, frees all confessing prisoners. Jesus Christ died for each and every one of us. He taught us how to love one another. He taught us how to forgive one another. He exemplified a perfect, loving life. What I'm hearing from those of you who have compassion here is that that is what we need to exemplify, a perfect, loving life, and learn how to forgive one another. What the advocate here is saying is that we need to move forward, forgive Cain, but he's also saying that Adam needs to confess his sins to allow his own pardon. I am not in a position to decide that Adam has sinned. I'm not in a position to determine that Adam was the cause of Cain's offense, for lack of a better word. So as a result of that, if we look at 5,000 years of history, and we think about the criminals that are in prison for 25, sometimes 15 years, and suddenly they're born again, we have to consider that somewhere in 5,000 years, you have gained a sense of remorse within yourself. So whatever the crime, whether it was murder, whether it was an accident, whether it was suicide, that's a whole other panel discussion, we need to learn to forgive one another. Are there any closing remarks from any of the council here?
I must say I admire the faith in human beings that many of you are shown. I'm not positive that it's always justified by the scriptural record, but I certainly am moved like anyone else that this foundational document can be interpreted in different ways, and I applaud the positive view that you have. But again, I would counsel that you stay close to Scripture, that you work with it, and don't forget justice. You know, don't forget justice.
As a member of the jury, I'd like to say that I realize I looked at you, prosecutor, and called you counsel for the defense, and so I would like to commend you that you're a very fine prosecutor, but within the side of you that knows how to condemn, there's also a side of you that would be an equally fine advocate. And when you, I give you that charge yourself to explore gifts beyond those that you have shown so well in this courtroom today.
Thank you. And also, I want to add to that, as you talk of justice, remember mercy.
And as you talk of mercy, remember justice.
Thank you. Do you have any final comments?
Thank you. I think Cain has had a day in court, Your Honor, and I thank the court for hearing the case.
Thank you. thank all of you for being here.
We have quite a bit of time. Do we want to just more now not talk in characters?
Talk informal?
Is there anyone that would like to just...
What did you think of it?
Gary!
Well, I thought it was very interesting that, number one, Cain never showed up. No one wanted to be Cain. Very interesting. Number two, Jesus didn't show up. Very interesting. And, you know, I think my own sense here was that... this was kind of intriguing for many people. Suddenly, I think at some point along the road, everyone, including myself, suddenly realized we were jumping into levels that we weren't sure we wanted to float around in. These are archetypal realities. Now, two things come to mind about this, about Cain. Two things I've learned from studying mythology and the great stories of all time. The chosen son always gets sacrificed. The rejected son always gets thrown out as the scapegoat. So, you know, each one has its burden to bear. And yeah. Cain really has carried a lot. Brigham Young made the statement that we need people like Cain because he helps keep the whole thing going, the whole system going. So, and that's kind of a harsh statement in a way. But if you look at family systems and you look at families and if you observe what happens in families, you find that basically there are roles in a family. And often there is the role of the scapegoat. And this goes into the animal kingdom as well as the human kingdom. It's not something we learn. So there is some need in all of us for a scapegoat, much as we don't like to face that reality. Somebody is going to be playing that role. And, you know, none of us want to be that, but that's what happens.
You know, I don't agree with you, because there are some people who actually enjoy being just that.
But my memory, of Rene Girard, though, is that he says that's the genius of Christianity. Yeah, that Jesus is the one that ends that the need for that. And if we truly understood that, at least that would be Rene Girard's statement.
I think it was grossly unfair for Eugene Kovalenko to sing. But I'm certainly glad that he did. He just made the argument impossible to go on its own merits.
One good quick comment. One of the evolutionary biologists I worked with made the statement, they did an experiment in which if you take rats and leave them in an environment in which they have food and plenty of space, everything goes fine. But when you start closing down the space, limiting the food supply, and the crowding especially, what happens is they begin to fight and they pick a scapegoat. Now, if you do this a number of times and you take the scapegoats out of each group and you put in a group of scapegoats together, the same thing happens. They pick a super scapegoat.
A thought came to me just now, just a few words from King David, the psalmist. He said, "Mercy and truth have kissed each other."
Mm. Very good.
I hope you all know I didn't enjoy playing the role I played. Just for the record.
You did it very, very well.
And I
like
the
shape of
playing it all around.
Yeah, without the framing for it. But I haven't talked about Gog and Magog in 30 years, I'm sure. So that was fun. But I do think this is an intriguing thing, and I do think that at some point, you know, most of us will intuitively get to the spot where you are if we were to think long and hard enough. So I really I appreciate the insight that you illustrated in such a fun way.
Well, thank you for coming.
You know, there's a precedent of this in old Mormon doctrine. Brigham Young, you know, and particularly Heber C. Kimball, they really talked about this doctrine that apparently got going with Joseph Smith and then was sort of snuffed out, was that at some point, sons of perdition would all be able to repent and start over again and get a new chance to go through a new cycle.
Ah. That sounds like the kind of conversation Joseph would have with Brigham and Heber C. Kimball and those kind of guys.
Now, I'm attracted to the universal salvation sort of sense that Mormonism really does have it in certain parts, but then you know, like everybody, there's personality types and temperaments, and some want, you know, some really just do favor justice over mercy, and it's hard for them to see it. But I mean, I can't imagine myself at some point saying, "Forever rejected." And I love it.
But if you think about justice and mercy and you try to make it an equal thing, now let's be realistic here. It's possible for it to be on an equal stand here. Because if we talk about Jesus Christ, due to his mercy, he gave us justice. So if you look at it on it can make it equal. Okay, it doesn't have to be one or the other. It just, we need to soften our hearts enough to allow it to be equal within us. We don't have to make a choice all the time.
You know, for me, this play started on a night with a dream, where I dreamed I was like Cain. I was on an altar, as I said earlier in this character. I was naked in a room full of Mormon high priests in their temple robes. And I was naked on an altar being prepared for something. I didn't know what it was. I was just there docile. And then a man whom I recognized in the dream came over to me and asked me a question. "Oh, aren't you Gene?" "Yes." "Well, how was Mazatlan?" I said that was an issue, a legal issue, technicality that I was involved with in real life, as a matter of fact, but that hadn't been able to fit. We hadn't been able to do a legal resolution of something. And so that was a blemish. And so this person who was a sycophant type person, an obsequious person, went over to the presiding authority and whispered in his ear something, and I don't know what he said. All I know is that the presiding authority, on hearing this, was startled and looked over at me and said, didn't say anything, he gestured with this "out," like you're out, like in baseball. You know. And I got up and I was frightened. And I got up and I began running. I didn't know why. All I knew was I was being rejected. And I ran out into the night, naked. And I hear the angry voices behind me. "I'll kill him! I'll kill him!" And then the other voice, "No, no one in this church ever better be found killing one of these." I'm in the Bay Area in California. And what is this? Well, I was to learn about what that was a month later, when I was visited by two members of the High Council with an official letter of excommunication. And I looked at the date on the letter, went to my dream journal. What do you know? It's the same time. Now, I thought, after I thought about that, for even several years. Wait a minute. I didn't kill nobody. I didn't kill nobody. What's going on here? Wow, there's something going on. So that's when I began thinking about this. Then, after I came back in the church 10 years later, I had two other dreams that make the triumphant of this play. The first dream was of an Abel-like character, a braggart standing out in the light, bragging, and he's infuriating this character in the shadows, a killer in the shadows, who finally comes out to do this guy in. That's one dream. The third dream, years later, is my own father in the dream. I'm doing something that he disapproves of. And he rises up in great indignation, about to strike me. And in the dream, I raise up, take his wrist, and pull him to his knees, And as he goes down, this is the thing that was striking. As he goes down, his face and expression change, and from this indignation comes a smile as to say, "Son, it's about time." And that he was a powerful change. I lost my fear of that kind of an authority as a result of that event. I put that together in this dream, in this play.
I'm curious, Indigo Children, where did that come from? I was being real there.
Son, you want to say something about that?
Well, okay, wow.
You're looking at one.
Get at the mic.
The tape, please.
Okay, to say it quick, there are people blessed on this earth to be able to see auras and see the spiritual energy field of people. We read about this in the Doctrine and Covenants as spirit being matter. All spirit is matter. It's just of a finer and purer sort. So there actually are people that are able to see this spirit matter. Some of these people started recognizing, and it had been prophesied in various forms before, but they started seeing a change in color and energy pattern in children being born in the early 80s. And then observing these children as they started to grow up, observed them demonstrating remarkable spiritual gifts and abilities of different kinds, some of clairvoyance and some of extreme compassion, a variety of spiritual gifts manifesting. And you can observe a parallel talking about like needing to discipline children and the difficulty we find in the school systems these days in disciplining children that didn't used to be such a problem is when we're trying to fit this new type of human into this old box, and they're just really going crazy, and we've got ADD and ADHD up the wazoo all over the place, and we're trying to drug them down and keep them under control, but they're just trying to break out all over the place, and they're much more creative and all these sorts of things. So
everybody with ADD is an indigo child?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
I'm just curious. I sort of was prosecuted, and I apologize. But I was just curious. I mean,
So instead of calling them ADD, you call them indigo.
Well,
yeah.
Gene, can you tell us anything about how the little drama turned out on other occasions when you presented it?
Yes. The first time I presented this was at a metaphysical society in August of 1978, just after the change of policy. And I had written this play before that change of policy. It was earlier that year. The idea has actually came the year before to put it together. But when the policy changed, it was astonishing to me. And the play was already pretty well written. I had recorded it for one of my sons, who has since taken his own life, which was a big shock. But I had made this play as a birthday gift for him on his 17th birthday. That was my first recording of it. And then the first performance, public performance, was at this metaphysical society in Upland, California. And I was astonished at what happened in the second act, how many people got into it. And, of course, in the metaphysical world, people are less inhibited than we are in other more conservative congregations.
I thought there were some uninhibited people here.
I was pretty pleased to see some of them come here. But it was a very large audience. I would say it was several hundred people in it. And it was recorded. That second act was priceless. Well, at about that time, I moved to Provo. Oh, the second performance was a month later at Pepperdine University for a university class, most of which were athletes. And most of those athletes were black. And it was a wholly different experience. They wanted more singing.
So did I.
They were very excited by the music and the idea. They had these were not LDS folks or didn't even know about the Mormon business of the priesthood and so forth. So they didn't have the connection with Cain as the Mormons, Mormon community did and had to deal with for so long.
I have no connection with Cain whatsoever. Can you do that?
Yes.
It reminds me from our experience here today, Virginia Satir, who now has passed on, was a famous family therapist. When I was in residency training in San Francisco years ago, she came on Saturday and she just gave us a brief outline of a family. This is right at the time of the Vietnam War. And then she just picked members of our residency group, of us doctors, to play the various roles, father, mother, oldest son who was getting drafted, another younger son, daughter, and so forth. And that's all. We started out, and I tell you, it was one of the most interesting experiences because we evolved over the next several times a whole story of, you thought it was a real family with all the conflicts. And I saw that happening here today. In other words, we get into it and we bring our own stories into the play.
That's great.
Yes. Well, thank you. It's always.
You were going to tell us a third time.
A third time. Oh, I moved to Provo and stayed with in the home of Eugene England for a while, a very dear friend. And that's where I met Clifton Jolly. Clifton was to be here. He was supposed to play the prosecutor, and he also was dying to play Lucifer
in the round table.
But he was called, as a matter of fact, as we speak, he is in Africa. He was called out of town last week, and we had to shuffle around.
So the day we went to press the program, I volunteered.
That's right, Dan.
That was fun.
Well, and so I shared this tape that was recorded in Upland with Clifton, and he got all excited. He says, it's got all kinds of good stuff in it, but it needs to be rewritten, and he wanted to help rewrite it. So I gave him the tape. I didn't make any copies, and he lost it. And he has been most repentant. I finally, because it was, you know, you can't replace such a thing. Last summer at Sunstone, I encountered him with this loss of long ago because I had lost track of him. And he promised that he would help me put this together. And he had one of his sons assigned to help me redo the play. And he, as I say, wanted to come here and be a part of it. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it.
Well, tell him he hasn't repented yet.
Come on, that's not mercy.
But it's justice.
I would just like to add one thing. Jane has had the courtesy of sending me a copy of these two, this presentation and his presentation on Saturday on Arnold Toynbee. I would recommend all of you hear that presentation. I think it will be the best paper in Sunstone, the best I've heard in years. I think it is a profound paper. And I just hope if you don't get a chance to read it, either read it or get the tape, it is truly a paper that needs to be published, I think, then.
Thank you.
And actually, it'll take this topic of fathers and sons and children and take you to a new place with it. I didn't hear you describe whose paper.
Eugene,
Saturday. He's presenting a paper Saturday on Arnold Toynbee's visit and so forth.
This coming Saturday.
This coming Saturday, on the 30th, at 3:30. Thank you for coming.
Seth, you were great.